KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Folsom, California.
Noe Valley.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, the story behind one of the Bay Area's most distinctive sounds.
It's like a giant with their hand on the giant chalkboard.
Then a story about how Muni's oldest streetcar survived the chopping block.
He hid them in the back of the car house, and they were out of sight, out of mind.
And a new Oakland exhibit tells untold stories from queer history.
Those stories that have been lost, or quite frankly, hidden because of shame, because people have lost their lives and the stories died with those people.
Queer California, that story and more today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. We're going to start off today's show with a story from our journalism project, Hey Area. You write in with questions and our reporters find the answers. And there's one thing that seems to inspire the most questions. BART trains. BART writer and KALW listener Michael Mackin had a question about that sound we know so well. And KALW's transportation reporter Eli Wirtschafter went out to find him some answers. Here's Eli.
Every morning, Michael Mackin gets on BART with two bags. There's a satchel where he keeps all his work stuff, and a backpack where he carries his two adorable little dogs.
Cooper, look at me. Cooper, speak.
Cooper, speak. Cooper and Jetta are the most well-behaved pets you've ever seen, and they are totally chill commuting in a backpack. If only their owner Michael had such a pleasant time riding BART.
Yeah, I get to work and I feel like I've just gone through an ordeal.
BART hurts his ears. And see, Michael, he's more concerned about his hearing than the average person. It's because of something that happened to him when he was a kid.
As a child, like most kids, I loved swimming.
And one day he was swimming in a pool and he felt this pain in his ear. Turned out he had an ear infection and it burst his eardrum.
It was very painful and blood came out. It was not a very good day in my life.
He had to get surgery. They cut his ear most of the way off and then put it back together.
There was a fear that I would, might lose my hearing in that ear.
After that, Michael likes to be cautious about his hearing, especially on BART.
It's like a giant with their hand on the giant chalkboard. It's really uncomfortable.
And that's the reason why Michael rode into Hey Area. It's why we met. It's why we ended up on BART together. He wants to know.
So can BART damage your hearing?
What?
I'm wondering if the loud sound on BART can damage your hearing.
Good question. So to find out, I went from one of the loudest places in the Bay Area to one of the quietest.
It isolates the patient from any movement or sound we make on the outside.
Dr. Xuan Lim is a clinical audiologist here at the University of the Pacific. We're in a silent room where she gives hearing tests to her patients.
Parents love this room. They always say, "Can I bring it home with me?"
That's because daily noise in the city can be a strain for anybody. When you're exposed to any loud noise,
BART or concert or restaurant, sometimes you may leave feeling a little deafer.
Dr. Lim explains that inside your ears, you have these little hair cells that pick up sonic vibrations. And if you hit them with a loud enough sound,
you can actually blow off the little hair cells from their attachment on the membrane.
Yow. Those hairs will reattach themselves, but only so many times.
I like to tell my patients, if you think about walking on a lawn of grass, when you walk on the grass bends, but the next day they're fine. But if you continually walk on that same patch of grass, it just kind of ruins the grass and the grass goes away. It's the same thing with your hair cells in your ear.
So being in loud places like BART every day can hurt your hearing. But how loud is too loud? Dr. Lim gets out the charts.
I knew you were gonna ask.
She knew it. Here's the question. Michael rides BART for an hour every day. How loud is too loud for an hour?
So let's see here. If they give it to you.
Found it. According to NIOSH, that's the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, the safe limit is 94 decibels, about as loud as sitting in the back row of a Billy Joel concert. Louder than that, probably harmful. So, time to do an experiment. Dr. Lim and I leave the clinic and get on a train. We want to see if the average noise is less than 94 decibels.
So we're on the BART train and we're about to head through the tunnel. We have a sound level meter in my hands and we're going to measure the amount of noise exposure on the train.
Dr. Lim is holding a device that looks like a giant high-tech thermometer.
With a really big fluffy ball on the end.
It measures noise in decibels over time. Our plan is to ride from downtown SF to MacArthur Station in Oakland and back again. The train starts to get loud.
We got a new peak of 113.
113 decibels is a lot, but that's the loudest we got. The average was much lower. Remember, we hoped the average would be less than 94 decibels. And what did we get?
When we were underground, the average noise level was around 86 to 88, and above ground, anywhere from 68 to 76.
So, bottom line, based on NIOSH standards and our brief sample, BART is okay. But, says Dr. Lim, you're better safe than sorry. In her professional opinion, BART riders like Michael should protect their ears anyway.
Michael, if you are bothered by the noise and you're consistently on BART, I would definitely get some earplugs or noise-canceling headphones.
All right, so I brought this back to Michael, our question asker. Turns out he owns noise-canceling earbuds, and he wears them like a pro. Instead of drowning out the BART noise with loud music,
often I'll put the headphones in and I'll turn the noise-canceling on and I'll read.
But the noise of BART still bothers him. So Michael isn't satisfied.
Is there anything that we could do moving forward to quiet the experience?
What else can BART do? Well, they hear you, Michael, and they've been working on it.
We have found a way that it's going to prevent the loud screech that everyone knows.
This is Alicia Trost from BART. We're in the Hayward maintenance shop looking at a wheel truing machine. The machine basically grinds wheels the same way a potter shapes a spinning vase.
This will be the machine that will get the new attachments to cut the new profile.
The rims of the old wheels are flat. The new rims have a tapered design that helps them turn more quietly. But it will take 2 or 3 years to switch all the wheels to the new design. Until then, Michael is protecting his hearing as best he can. And so his thoughts turn to his dogs.
I often wonder too whether I should be putting earmuffs on them, and they make earmuffs for dogs.
Should dogs protect their ears on BART? These dogs are like, ah, what noise?
And he doesn't seem to care. Not like his owner. I care.
In a BART tunnel for Cross Currents, I'm Eli Wirtschafter.
Eli is KELW's transportation reporter. Since that story first aired, nearly all of BART's legacy fleet have new, quieter wheels, and 60 new cars have gone into service. So if you've got a question you want us to investigate, go to KELW.org and look for Hey Area. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. A few months ago, we sent Audio Academy fellow Magnolia McKay to find the oldest streetcar in San Francisco. Well, she found it, and she reported a short story about it. But there's so much more to tell. She uncovered a kind of Cinderella story about a humble little streetcar that was once the laughing stock of the city. Here's Magnolia.
I'm on the yard where San Francisco's oldest working streetcar lives. When I get there, it's surrounded by Muni workers in blue shirts. They're excited because this antique streetcar doesn't get out much. They call it the Dinky.
This car, it's got an ancient controller, so you have to be very careful with it.
Robert Parks works for Muni. He shows me how he drives the Dinky. You apply power, release the brake, ring the gong, and get going. Dinky is adorable. It's short and boxy, painted a cheerful yellow color, and it still has its 19th century woodwork. To be honest, the ride is rather bumpy, but there was a time when this was the smoothest, quickest way around the city. Let's go back to the 1890s when streetcars first hit the scene in San Francisco. If you want to talk streetcars, transit historian Emiliano Echeverria is your man. He's a lifelong rail fan and even did track maintenance in the cable car system.
The electric trolley car was high tech. In its day, it was the thing going on.
In that time, the transit companies were all privately owned. Emiliano tells me that Dinky was built for one of these private companies in 1896. It was given the number 578 and painted yellow. The color indicated its route.
Which was very important because there were many, many people at that time who were either immigrants who were not familiar with English or people who were actually illiterate who couldn't read or write at all.
Back then, car number 578 was actually one of many Dinkies. All short, small streetcars were called Dinkies because of their size. But by the early 1900s, the Dinkies were already going out of style, getting replaced by bigger streetcars. Our Dinky could have easily gone to the scrapyard. But then came the great earthquake of 1906. The earthquake and fire leveled most of the city. And remember, this is before automobiles. So to rebuild, the rail companies turned their Dinkies into construction vehicles.
There were streetcars for carrying tools. There were streetcars for towing a wrecked car. Streetcars for carrying sand. Even cars for lifting track out of the street, everything.
Our Dinky became a sand car. San Francisco's famous hills and fog make rail transit a bit too slippery at times. So Dinky's new job was to drop sand on the rails to give passenger streetcars more traction. And actually, streetcars still do that today, only now they carry their own sand on board. But back to Dinky. When it went to work, it was boarded up, stripped of its seats, and painted a dull green. The life of a sand car was far less glamorous than that of a passenger streetcar. But getting this assignment was Dinky's first lucky break. Because old cars that didn't get a job, they were scrapped. Not our Dinky. Dinky worked as a sand car for decades.
World War I happens.
Dinky is delivering sand.
World War II happens. The Depression happens.
Dinky is still delivering sand. But its life was about to be threatened again. In the 1940s, Muni was expanding and took over the last of the private rail companies. But after two wars and a depression, those tracks and streetcars were in terrible shape. So in 1947, Muni put a bunch of bond measures on the ballot.
Let's raise money to rebuild the railway. Let's buy buses, let's buy trolley coaches, get those darn streetcars and those darn tracks off the streets.
Muni had a parade to raise support for the propositions.
And let's get the most decrepit, most ancient-looking thing we've got.
And they found our Dinky. They painted a slogan on it. My wheels are flat, my body sags, my upholstery is in rags.
Please vote for 1-7 and send me to streetcar heaven.
Dinky was the poster child for Muni's crumbling infrastructure, paraded around the streets of San Francisco like the bad kid in a dunce cap. It worked. The props to modernize Muni passed. That meant more buses and fewer rail cars. There wasn't much use for a sand car anymore, so it looked like Dinky's fate was sealed. The writing was literally written on its wall. One by one, the sand cars went to the wrecker.
Whoop, that went the sand car to the wrecker.
But then, Dinky got its second lucky break. It caught the eye of a Muni shop foreman named Charles Smallwood. He happened to be a rail fanatic, and he saw the beauty underneath the years of wear and tear. He got the idea to restore Dinky and some other old work cars.
He hid them in the back of the car house. So he would stash them there, and they were out of sight, out of mind.
So this guy had the gall to hide something bigger than an elephant until he raised the funds to have it restored. Train a ride.
slow.
In 1956, Smallwood raised enough funds to restore Dinky to its former beauty. And the car that was once the dingiest in Muni's fleet became a show car. Dinky was sent to museums, and it starred in parades. Even a campaign parade for Richard Nixon. Nixon now. Nixon now. But Dinky's most crucial role came in 1983. At that time, San Francisco's iconic cable car system was being overhauled. That meant that all of the cable cars would be out of service for almost 2 years. City officials were worried that that would be bad for tourism, so they had an idea.
Let's run historic streetcars up and down Market from the Castro to the Bay Bridge Terminal, and that will satisfy people's, you know, desire to ride historic rail equipment.
Dinky was one of the stars of the show. It started as a one-time festival, and...
well, the darn thing was a blasting success.
San Francisco decided to make it a regular thing. Muni ran the restored cars they had, and then started importing more historic cars from all over the world.
That's the F line.
F, as in festival. Emiliano says that when the historic streetcars started running back in the 80s, downtown had a depressed look about it.
Nobody likes to get on a dreary, depressing bus or a streetcar. You want to get on something that's nice, pretty. And the F line shows the transit can be fun. It can be pretty. It can be enjoyable.
I think it's really charming.
This is Norris Hung. I find him on the platform in front of the ferry building. One might think of the historic fleet as something for tourists, but Norris is a local, and he takes the F from time to time.
It's a really cool mix of something that seems both like a relic of San Francisco, but also practical.
In a rapidly growing city that's covered in construction cranes, the F line connects us to our past. Dinky only comes out for special occasions now. It's over 120 years old. But its legacy lives on. If Dinky hadn't been rescued and restored, we might not have an F line now. Who would have imagined that a dusty old sand car from the 1890s would inspire a whole fleet of vintage streetcars? Our Dinky came from humble beginnings, but it's now the crown jewel of Muni's fleet. In San Francisco, I'm Magnolia McKay for Cross Currents.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell.
Magnolia is a fellow in KELW's Audio Academy. And you can take a ride on Dinky when it comes out for Muni Heritage Weekend every September. Find out more at KELW.org.
Thump, thump, thump went my heartstrings. When he smiled, I could feel the car shake. He tipped his hat and took a seat. He said he hoped he hadn't stepped upon my feet. He asked my name, I held my breath. I couldn't speak because he scared me half to death. Buzz, buzz, buzz went the buzzer.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. This is a big year for the Oakland Museum of California. Curators are getting ready for another major exhibit this spring. It's called Queer California, Untold Stories, and it explores the LGBTQ culture and history in the state. In the fall, the museum will celebrate its 50th anniversary. And the museum's changed a lot over 50 years. It's even become a Friday night hotspot. KLW's Janae Darden visited the museum to learn why it has evolved. She spoke with Deputy Director Kelly McKinley.
I remember the Oakland Museum back in the days, back in the 80s and early 90s, and the Oakland Museum has evolved. Can you talk about how the museum was then and how it is now?
When it was built as a museum of the people, and I think what we're doing today is really delivering on that original mission. The way I would describe the big changes are moving from the kind of place, the kind of museum that's more didactic, teaching you stuff about stuff, and more to a place where let's create a platform to lift up people's stories and use those stories as an opportunity to connect people to one another.
I went to the hip-hop exhibit. I never thought in my day I would see a lowrider in the in the Oakland Museum. How did you all come up with these ideas to have this Black Power exhibit, to have the hip hop exhibit, to have the upcoming Queer California exhibit? Are you talking to the community? Are you bringing people inside?
We get asked this question all the time, but it really is the job of our curators first and foremost to be out in the community, talking to people, watching TV, listening to the news, really trying to figure out what's going on and what are the conversations that are happening at people's dining room tables.
Is this what we're seeing from other museums around the country? Because you're talking about connecting to community, and I know just to these exhibits, they're very interactive, very multimedia. And it's not, as you said, talking to people, but letting people be a part of it, be a part of the learning experience. Is this a new trend? Is this the future of museums?
Well, I think it's the future of museums. If museums are going to be relevant to people, if museums are going to sustain themselves into the future, I think they absolutely need to do this work. How we do it is very particular to Oakland, so I wouldn't say that this is a recipe that you could just apply to other cities. You've really got to develop stories and ways of telling those stories that are authentic to that place.
What have been or what is probably your most popular exhibit?
It was All Power to the People, the Black Panthers at 50. It broke all attendance records for this institution. It was the highest attended. Previous to that, the highest attended exhibit that was sort of the gold standard was our Pixar exhibition. And the Black Panther exhibition broke that record too.
What were the numbers?
I think we had 85,000 visitors.
For the Black Panthers? Mm-hmm. What was for Pixar?
It was close to that, but Black Panthers broke it. It was close to that for sure.
Wow, 85,000.
Yes, we were thrilled. And what was
Did you think it was? You think it was going to be that big?
We knew it was going to be big. I don't think we thought it would be that big. And, you know, as you're talking to me, I've got this picture in my head of the last week or two. Those last couple weekends were insane. People were lined up down the block before we were even open. After the Black Panther exhibition, we had so much feedback from the community. It's like, well, where's this story going to go? Isn't there a place for this story on a more permanent basis? So we've repurposed some of the content and kind of distilled that story down and created a new section in the history gallery called Black Power, which is really looking at that moment in the 60s.
So I can get a little peek of it, a little snack of what I missed.
We can give you a little snack of what it's, yes, it is a definitely a snack size of a very big exhibition, yeah.
So you're talking about, you know, you're doing important stories. And another one, definitely a huge important story to the history of California is the LGBTQ movement. Queer California, Untold Stories. What is so unique or distinct that makes this one a first of its kind?
Mm-hmm. Three things. One is that it's not just a straight art show or a straight history show. It's a real multimedia experience. Number two, I would say it's because it's focused on untold stories, those stories that have been lost or, quite frankly, hidden because of shame about those stories, because people have lost their lives and the stories died with those people. And I would say the third thing is this notion of a queer future, which is part of the story of the exhibition, a future where people could live their true selves and identify in whatever way they saw fit and could be accepted and part of a mainstream culture.
When is the actual 50th anniversary?
Yeah, so it's September 20th, and we're going to be celebrating our 50th over the whole year, September to September.
Have you seen a boost in membership and a boost in donations since the museum has evolved to what it is today?
Yeah, we've seen lots of changes. We've had more membership members than we've had in our entire history. We've got over 10,000 member households, which is huge for a museum of our size. Now, just over 50% of our total visitorship are people of color, where before that was around 20%. So that's over a period of about 5 years.
Anything for the 50th celebration people can expect?
Well, very luckily, the 20th of September is a Friday, so we are going to have a Mondo Friday night birthday party for ourselves.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. The food trucks that will be out there.
And the birthday candles, they will be lit. Pardon the pun.
I see what you did there.
So that's just the kickoff. There will be lots of different programs throughout the year.
Any future exhibits that you can drop for us?
Well, this fall, just after we light the candles for our 50th anniversary party, we'll be opening an exhibition called No Spectators, The Art of Burning Man. After Burning Man, we're developing an exhibition yet to be titled that will be in 2020, and it's going to be on feminism. And the date is pretty important because 2020 is the 100th anniversary of women getting the vote. And it's also election year, so we like the lining up of women, suffrage, and the election.
That was Oakland Museum of California Deputy Director Kelly McKinley speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. The exhibit Queer California Untold Stories opens April 13th. We got some details at KALW.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our newsletter. Make sure you get all our stories every week right in your inbox. This music is by Oakland-based singer Lelon Kane. She's performing at the Black Cat in San Francisco tomorrow night. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
But was it ever there to begin with? I loved you strong, but you didn't even care. I gave myself to you, tried to keep my heart at bay. Protected from the silly games, I've heard you lie.